Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies. Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies, and today we're going to talk to a man who makes really good ones and has been doing so for a long time. Sam Pollard is a master documentarian, master editor, master director, and his latest film is called The League, and we're going to talk primarily about that, but also about his whole career.
Yeah.
And I
have to tell you, Sam, that when we got the email asking if we would interview you, I don't know the last time I saw my dad jump that quickly. And he just went nuts and was so excited. And he came to me and he said, "Oh my gosh, we get to interview Sam Pollard." He is a huge fan and has made me a huge fan of yours. And very, very excited we get to speak to you today.
Thank you, Jesse. Thank you very much.
It's true.
Now, the League is about the, I want to say it right, the Negro National League, the National
League. It's about the Negro Baseball League. There were many configurations of it. You know, there's a Negro National League, Negro American League. Yeah, so it was about the Negro Baseball League that basically prospered from 1920 to 1960.
And it is a fascinating piece of Americana. And certainly of Black culture in this country, and I wonder why no one has done this before.
Well, I think, you know, there's been little films about it that's usually found on the internet. This is the first time we've had the opportunity to do a really big film that we think will grab an audience, and I think it's about time. I mean, the Negro Leagues were around for so long; they had such phenomenal players. You know, a lot of those players ended up playing in the major leagues after Jackie Robinson went to the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. So this is an opportunity to really tip our hat to this important group of ball players and what they did to really change the whole rhythm and pace of baseball when they got into major leagues, into the major leagues.
Even though this was an act of segregation, you might say, those ball clubs thrived, and those players were heroes to their community. And they even barnstormed at one point, just going around like traveling all-stars.
Well, you remember that movie, John Badham's Bingo Long's Traveling
Yes,
All-Stars
indeed.
And Motor Kings. So that sort of was based on the Negro Leagues, and they did. I mean, they didn't make a lot of money, so when the seasons were over, they would play other teams. Like, in one year, they played Satchel Paige, and the Negro League players played Dizzy Dean and Daffy Dean and other Major League Baseball players, and it was a big sellout for a lot of those traveling games. And, you know, and even Bob Feller, who, you know, great Cleveland Indians pitcher, played against Satchel Paige in the 40s. So it was a time when, even though we were living in a time of segregation and Jim Crow, these teams within these Black communities thrived, and they helped the communities economically. They helped the communities in terms of entertainment. You know, they really sort of, if you see the footage, you see how excited the fans were to be in those stadiums in Pittsburgh, in Newark, in New York, in Baltimore, all over in Philadelphia, where they all had Negro League teams. So it was an exciting period.
You bring all that to life really well. And I know that doing this kind of an archival documentary, which you have done before, is largely dependent on the eyewitnesses that are either still alive or who have, you know, done a video or a film beforehand, an interview beforehand. But I could never have suspected that your primary eyewitness would be an umpire.
I know. And that all has to do with Byron Motley, who was the one who originally came to me about over 8 years ago with the idea of wanting to do a film about his dad, Bob Motley, who was an Negro League umpire in the 40s and the 50s. And they had written a book together about his dad's adventures and misadventures being a Negro League umpire and growing up in the South, going into the Marines and coming out with this desire. He initially wanted to be a baseball player, but he knew he didn't have the skills, so he became an umpire. And I thought this, you know, you're always looking, you know, Jesse and Lenny, you're always looking for a hook.
Of course. To tell these
stories. And we found that hook with Bob Motley. And I think that was a great way to bring the audience into this story, this amazing story about the Negro Leagues.
Well, he has all the things he wants as a filmmaker, as an interviewer. He has a great memory, a memory for detail, a memory for the atmosphere, what it felt like, and he's articulate. Mm. A dream interviewee.
That was important, you know, to be able to have someone who could tell you those stories, who could bring you into the moment, who can engage you. Yeah. You know, and I always say with documentaries, much like with dramatic films, you're looking for engaging characters who mm-hmm. can, you know, keep the audience involved.
Well, the two players, of course, that transcended the limitations or restrictions of that time and became really well known were Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson.
Yeah.
And even people who never saw a game, white people who never saw a game from this vantage point, knew of Satchel Paige. He became really famous, and not just famous, but almost notorious for his skill, his sheer skill.
Well, like, for example, you know, in the film, we had that sequence, an animated sequence where he calls in the outfield, he has them all sit down, and he strikes out the side of the opposing team. That's how special Satchel Paige was. He was a legend. He was a legend. And, you know, I grew up in the 60s in New York City, and I knew a little bit about the Negro League, but the two players, like you just said, Leonard, the two players that I knew about more than anybody else was Josh Gibson and Satchel Paige, because they were legends. They were absolute legends.
That's true. That's not hype. That's true.
Listening to you, I don't think I've ever heard. My dad doesn't talk sports. This may shock you. Not generally something he's up on. But it blows my mind that even you. And we were talking about that the other day.
Well, yes. Well,
because he also, growing up in New York, New Jersey, at a certain time, you couldn't not know about certain players. It was whether it was something that you actively sought or not, you knew. Well, and it was exciting to you.
I was in New York and in the suburbs in Teaneck, New Jersey, and that was the Yankees golden era, 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
The Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris era. And one of the great events of my young life was when Elston Howard moved in around the corner from us.
Elston Howard, huh? Wow.
Yes. Teaneck actually was notable for having a black population, but it was redlined.
Right.
They're in a specific area of town, but not Elston Howard. He could live where he was.
He lived wherever he
was.
He was
a heroic
well
figure, and he could live anywhere he damn well pleased.
Yeah, he was one of the. It was who was on that team? It was
Bill
Bobby
Moose Gowron.
Moose Gowron, Tony Kubek.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I remember that team. I never was a Yankee fan though. I was never a Yankee.
I just this is the genuinely the
most sports I've ever discussed
that have ever come out of your ever in the history of you. It's incredible.
Well, this film brought it out of me.
Yeah.
Well,
Leonard, did you know that Satchel Paige was in a Robert Mitchum movie in 1959?
No, I should, but I don't.
It's a Western called The Wonderful Country, directed by Robert Parrish, mm-hmm. with Robert Mitchum and Julie London. And Satchel Paige plays a black cavalry soldier in that movie.
Because oh, wow.
Like cavalry regiment. The 1959, The Wonderful Country.
All right,
you have a homework assignment.
I have a homework assignment, and I will dutifully take that up.
Like it's hard to get you to watch a Western. Yeah, right. His favorite. Now, so where did you grow up, Sam?
I grew up in East Harlem on 99th Street and 2nd Avenue in New York City in the night from 1955 to 1972.
Yeah. Wow. And what got you into film?
I was going to Baruch College in New York City, majoring in marketing. I was going to be a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And in my junior year, I hated all my business classes. I went to see my college counselor and I said I was looking for some after-school internship. And she asked me what I liked the most. And I told her I loved reading books and I loved those old Hollywood movies. I had grown up with the, you remember Linda, when RKO had WOR, they had the yes. RKO library.
Yes, so I used million to watch, dollar movie.
Yeah, I used to watch Million Dollar Movie every day. Citizen Kane, Out of the Past, King Kong. So I loved all those movies and the film noir movies with Charles McGraw, you know. So she told me about this film workshop from WNET. It was a one-year workshop. Professionals came in and taught you how to edit, how to shoot,
wow,
how to produce, how to do sound. I joined the workshop and I gravitated toward the editing. My whole life changed. I worked on my first film in 1972 titled Ganja and Hess, directed by Bill Gunn, as an apprentice editor.
And that was it.
That was it.
Now, we're going to talk about your collaboration and relationship with Spike Lee in just a minute.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But jumping ahead out of sequence, you started then working with film.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna. You had like Final Cut Pro, right? That's what you started with, and you.
No, you kidding? No. Right?
We have a Moviola in the house.
I started on a Moviola.
And this is the thing: whenever my filmmaker friends would come over and they'd be complaining about any number of things, I would walk them over to the Moviola,
yeah,
and I would say, "I'm sorry, what? What was? Could you just one more time?" You know, and my dad, when I was little, because we have film, he has a film collection, and you showed me how you would physically cut, and you have your little, you still have the same thing you've had since you were 13.
Yeah, a little 8mm splicer.
A little splicer. Ooh. Like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And you still have the same tape,
yes,
from when you were 13.
Yes.
You right. have to be very careful opening the box, and, you know, and we would very carefully tape. So yeah, whenever anybody complained to me, I would show them this, and I would say, "I'm sorry, I can't hear you. What was the problem?"
Now, I'm not asking this in a let the dogs settle
down. Let the dogs bark. Yeah,
I'm not asking this in a prejudicial or judgmental way, but do you think that editing on a Moviola gave you a kind of an inner rhythm or an instinct for cutting?
Well, because I would say yes, and this is why I would say yes, because when you used to cut on the Moviola, then when I transitioned to the Steenbeck, you know, when you went to make a cut, you really had to think about the mm-hmm. why of the cut. You had to think about what that was going to mean to the overall structure and pacing of the film.
Yep.
So you wouldn't just make a cut and not think about it. You would really think, you know. So completely, I would completely agree that my pacing and my rhythm was informed by me cutting film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I cut film for over 20 years. So.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Spike Lee was one of the last holdouts.
Yeah.
For shooting and cutting on film.
The last film I cut for Spike was Clockers, 1995.
Wow.
The last film I cut on film for Spike.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that is the thing. There is something about. And this is also true just shooting with film, that you have to be more aware and you have to think about what you're doing.
Yeah,
obviously
yeah,
now,
be thoughtful.
It is amazing what we have now. The technology is incredible. And the fact that if you wanted to, you could shoot 17,000 hours.
Well, you do now. See what happens, yeah. it's what happens now, you know.
Yeah.
Jesse,
yeah.
I was just in London on a shoot about 6 weeks ago for this photographer, this film about this photographer. And we shot, you know, digital. And we shot, I think we shot 12 hours a day in one day. and you know, and when you used to shoot film, particularly if you shot 16, you had a 400 foot mag.
Yep.
And you had to figure out how many mags you could shoot and how much you could afford.
Yeah.
You know, and if you had more than four or five, if you only had four or five mags, you had to really think about how much to cover and how much to get because you didn't have any more.
Well,
it doesn't
like
work like that now.
Shooting with the ends, I had a lot of friends that would just use the ends.
Yeah, short ends. You would shoot with short ends.
Give them, and they take whatever they had and you make it work.
Yeah, but nowadays, you know, I edited a documentary about Obama for HBO about 15 years ago. And we shot back then with the, you know, with the DV tapes, we shot 400 hours.
Yeah.
You know, 400 yeah. hours.
It's a different.
And I mean, as I say, it's nice that the technology exists. It's nice that somebody can shoot a film on their phone. It, you know, it's nice that yeah. anybody has the ability to do these things, but yeah. there is something about, again, it's that we're intention and paying attention and going, all right, here's what I have and here's what I need. And I need to really think about each.
What you're going to get. I mean, it's, yeah. it goes back to, you know, and you guys know this, it goes back to the way Ford would shoot or Hal Hawks would shoot. Andre de Toth would shoot, you know, they knew that they knew what they wanted to get. John Ford, yes. when he went out to Monument Valley, he knew what he needed to get. Right. He didn't give you a lot of extra coverage because he didn't want the editors messing with his cuts.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, a different orientation completely.
Yep. Yeah.
Now, so how smooth was your transition to digital editing?
At first, you know, I was sort of kicking and screaming. Because I would say, you know, like a lot of us who are old timers, we would say, I can't feel the film.
Yeah.
I can't feel the celluloid. But then I started to adapt because the one advantage to cutting digital that you didn't have when you used to cut 35 or 16, you know, this is that when you made trims and you put them on a hook in the barrel, if unfortunately one of those trims fell into the barrel, you would have to go deep in there to find these trims. You'd have a notebook where you'd have little trims taped that you'd have to put numbers on to make sure you put them in the right place. So I finally didn't miss that anymore.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the other advantage to digital that you could do with film, but you would always have to make new prints. If you want to recut a sequence
with film,
you'd have to make new prints of the takes you like.
Yes. Yes.
With digital, you would just go and find the same take and recut it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So walk us through what it was like to direct your first film.
It was a baptism of fire. I had been hired to work on a series, Eyes on the Prize, about the civil rights movement in 1986. Yep. And like a lot of editors, by that point in my career, I've been editing for like 12 years. I would always poo-poo all of the directors and say, oh, I could have shot that better. I could have did that better. You know, oh, they don't know what they're doing. And then all of a sudden, when I was faced with those decisions, I realized, I turned to myself, I said, oh, it's not so easy to get people to answer your questions. Oh, it's not so easy to go out and shoot this footage. Oh, it's really hard. You know, I was being more of a backseat driver. So it was, I was terrified at first. Oh my God, maybe I should forget directing and stick to the editing room. But then my ego kicked in and I said, well, I'm going to show I'm a good director, you know? Uh-huh. So I just pushed myself. And, you know, I'm a real student of film. So I would watch so many documentaries, the Maisels and Penny Baker, you know, and just to get to understand their technique and their approach to filmmaking, you know? So, you know, I finally got the grasp and I got the confidence to feel like I could make a documentary without being in the editing.
Yeah, yeah.
The Eyes on the Prize, of course, was a high watermark at that time.
Oh, yeah.
For depicting the civil rights movement. And but it's been just the beginning for you of a series of films on the Black experience in America. Do you think you're ever going to run out of material? I don't think you will.
No. There's always something, some new story to uncover or some new story to dig into, to look at from a different perspective. No,
yeah.
I think it'll be a lot of material for me until I stop.
Yeah.
Now, at one time, it was considered really bad form to do a dramatic recreation in a documentary. Well, that's because the dramatic recreations of those early days
were terrible.
Absolutely.
And now I think the audience, certainly the smart audiences of the kind who watch a documentary to begin with, understand the need that you don't have film to cover history at every stage, at every step. Mm-hmm. And you have to find some creative means to illustrate what you're talking about. And you did, I don't know how to describe the animation in The League. Would you try?
Well, what we decided was, and this is always a good thing about recreations in animation, if you make sure that you can find the storytellers that can engage the audience with the story that they're going to tell, then you can figure out how to do it in terms of visually. Is it going to be recreation? Is it going to be animation? And you really have to think about the animation look and the approach. You have to think about the recreation look and the approach. You know, the challenge you always have with recreations and animations, you don't want them to feel like cheesy. You don't want them to feel like too simple. You want to bring some, what I call cinematic production value to them. Mm-hmm. Cinematic production value. And, you know, I'm so influenced by so many films. I'm always thinking about techniques, about how to look at films. Like last night, someone reached out to me about doing a documentary about Emmett Till from a different perspective, you know, who was killed in 1955. Yeah. And they had a different approach in terms of who they were interviewing, his cousin. They interviewed his cousin. So I thought, well, how can I start this film? Mm-hmm. So you know what I did last night, folks? I was on Criterion Channel and I watched the opening of Reds. You know, I watched the opening of Reds and I was watching the interviews that Beatty did with all the people who had been a part of John Reed and Louise Bryan's life in the early 20th century. Right. And I thought, okay, this major character who was Emmett's cousin and he's 86, maybe if he's in good enough shape, I should get him in a room, you know, dress a set, but shoot it in black and white and shoot it really tight. You know, start with a wide shot of him sitting down and then cut to a really tight shot and try to give it a real sort of, you know, Chicaruso kind of flavor and flight, you know. And then as he's trying to tell the story about these young high school kids who had the transcripts of the trial that happened, I'll find a group of high school kids and I'll work with them, you know, to have them recreate the trial of Emmett Till. You know, it's a different approach. You know, like every time I'm doing a new film, I'm trying to think of a different way to engage the audience, the way I did MLK FBI or the way I did Sammy Davis, always any way I did Arthur Ashe, always trying to think of a different way to cinematically embrace the audience. So that's why, you know, when I'm getting ready to do a new film, I'm going back and watching Reds. I'm going back and watching Fellini. I'm going back and watching, you know, who's one of my other favorite film directors? Wong Kar-wai, you know, so I'm always studying the cinema of the filmmakers and Scorsese, who does great documentaries.
Scorsese was just saying that he and Thelma Schoonmaker always have TCM on in the background while they're editing.
And
he says because it inspires him.
It inspires. You know? It's like for me now, I watch TCM, I have TCM and I have Criterion. So I go back and forth. The other night I was watching this silly, silly movie from Warner Brothers 1941 with Anthony Quinn. It was terrible, but it was just fun to watch it. And then I was gonna watch Dick Powell, Elizabeth Scott in Pitfall. Remember that film?
Yep. Yeah. We actually got to know Andre de Toth.
He's a character, right?
Quite the character.
He's a great character, great director. I mean, two of my favorite films is Crime Wave and Pitfall.
Oh, well, Crime Wave is exceptional.
Yeah.
Exceptional. And yet, oddly, interestingly, it was a throwaway at the time.
I know.
It was not an A movie. It was not a major release, but it has held up very well.
Oh, yeah. Well, he had the great Sterling Hayden. Sterling Hayden.
Yep. How did you and Spike Lee first get together?
Here's a story. It's a great story. It's 1988. I think it was 88. I was finishing up Eyes on the Prize. I was living in the Back Bay section of Boston. And my two sons were staying with me for the weekend. One was 10, the other was 2.5. The phone rings in the apartment. My 10-year-old son picked up the phone. I had just seen Do the Right Thing with my wife. And so the phone rings, my son picks up the phone and he turns to me and he says, "Dad, Spike Lee's on the phone." And I turn to him and I say, Jason, stop pulling my leg, Spike Lee. You know, Dad, Spike Lee's on the phone. So I pick up the phone and it's Spike. And he said his production manager was a buddy of mine. And he had just recommended me to Spike to do, at the time, it was called Love Supreme, which became Mo Better Blues. Mm-hmm. And Spike asked me if I would edit the film because he knew I was a jazz fan. And I turned him down. Mm. I told him I was in the middle of finishing Eyes on the Prize. I really love the idea that you want me to edit, but I can't, I'm not available. So I hung up. 2 months passed. It was like July, and then it was right before Labor Day. Spike called me again. And another colleague of mine, the late St. Clair Bourne, had been working on the documentary about the making of Do the Right Thing. And he also said to Spike that I was a really good editor, he should hire me. So Spike called me again, guys, asked me again. And I said, Spike, I'm really busy. He said, well, I'm coming to Boston, let's meet. And coincidentally, he was going to Martha's Vineyard for the Labor Day weekend. And I was going to Martha's Vineyard for Labor Day. And so we met in Oak Bluffs. We spent a half hour in downtown Oak Bluffs at a coffee shop. And I don't think Spike said that much, but by the end of that meeting, I had talked myself into taking the film.
It sounds like trying to convert to Judaism. You have to go to the rabbi three times.
That's right.
Spike had to just keep knocking until you finally went, all right, okay.
Yeah, you know, and then it was, you know, five films and 12 years later.
I love that tribute piece that you did for the American Cinematheque. Honored Spike.
Yeah.
I thought that was really, really good.
Yeah, it was fun to do. It was fun to do. Yeah. Well, you know, and I got to know him as well as you can get to know Spike after all those years.
Yeah. That's a very good way to phrase that.
Oh yeah, he's a tough guy to get to know.
Yeah. He's a tough guy in general.
Oh yeah.
You know, he's a tough cookie. And that's putting it mildly at times, but I was working the Music Hall of Fame. That was for Music Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And he was there for, I think it was for Public Enemy. Mm-hmm. And all of us have been told, don't talk to him, don't make eye contact, like just leave him alone, right. You know, leave him alone. I turn a corner, he was wearing the pizza boy, and purple thing. Right. And he's like, he's about my height. And I just turn this corner and there he is dressed like that. In my mind, I'm going, do I run? Like, so I just went, hi, you look great. And he sort of acknowledged me and walked away. And I was like,
that's right.
Spike Lee. All right, I'll take it.
That's Spike.
Have you done some teaching too?
27 years at NYU, Leonard.
Well, that'll
do.
I just retired.
Mazel tov. That's teaching. My dad's been a teacher for 25 years, though you taught at the new school and I mean, even years ago, but truly being a teacher and you being a teacher, choosing to be a teacher is so important because you are so articulate, but also you have incredible experience
and passion
for this. And those kids are so lucky to have had you as a teacher.
But I look at it the other way.
They taught you, sure.
They taught me. I mean, I feel like that teaching of 27 years of all those different students, I saw so many types of filmmaking.
Yeah.
I was inspired.
Yeah.
I was constantly inspired by these students. I would say, wow. Some things I would say, man, I'm going to steal that and try that in my own films.
but that's what makes a good teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And that's it. And it's because you love this that it is exciting. It's exciting when someone shows you something and you see, oh my God, the possibilities. It's a thrill.
It definitely is. Still is for me. I mean, this is my 51st year of making films. So
wow. Now are you tough on your editors?
It depends. You know, if I'm fortunate to work with really seasoned editors, I'm not so tough.
Yeah.
If I work with editors who I can, you know, if I can smell a lack of confidence, I can be tough.
Yeah.
It's like I have to look at a cut in about an hour of a thing I'm working on. And I could tell his editor's a little lacking in confidence. I'm going to be tough on him today because I've been trying to get this sequence to work better.
So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the origin of MLK FBI?
It was based on a book by a professor of history named David Guerra. He had written a book about the FBI and how they monitored surveilling King for years. He lives in Pittsburgh. My producer on that film, Benedine, had said, man, we should turn this into a film. So we went out on our own dime. We went out to Pittsburgh. We hired a camera crew, a local crew, and we shot with David about 3 or 4 hours that one day, and then 2 or 3 hours the next day, to basically give us the frame of how to tell a story about King being surveilled. We put together a sizzle reel, and it took us about 2 years to raise the money, you know, about a million two. And then we shot some additional interviews with some scholars and close confidants of King. But the one thing I had said before we started editing, I said, I wanted to sort of do this film without seeing anybody on camera. And I had seen a film years ago called The Black Power Mixtapes that had been done in Europe. And they had done the whole film without anybody on camera, Cornel West, Amiri Baraka. So I wanted to emulate that approach. Mm. And that's how we decided to do the film. But just to be safe, I shot everybody on film, on video, just because if my funder, if the funder said they didn't want to see, they wanted to see the people on camera, I would do that. Right. And we only used them on the camera at the very end. The editor, my editor, she really came up with that idea. In the summation, in the epilogue, let's put everybody on camera.
Mm-hmm. And then it had twice the impact and the meaning.
Exactly, exactly.
Very, very good. That's a heck of a film.
Thank you.
And I say that as someone who grew up in an sort of an apolitical atmosphere. And I was one of those people, a white middle-class kid in the suburbs of New York, who bought into the FBI, what would you call it?
Propaganda.
Yes. I bought into that propaganda. I'm not proud of that now, but I was inculcated to admire and respect J. Edgar Hoover. And and you know, and what the FBI supposedly stood for. Yeah. And the job that they were supposed to be doing. So all of this, I've had a reawakening, but it is a reawakening for me.
Oh yeah,
and so that film was especially meaningful.
Thank you.
Well, it's, you know, this is what it's amazing to look back on these things now, right? You know, when you have, like, you're talking about, you know, the different perspectives of different people, and that is something that you can't fake, and you also can't change where someone grew up, how someone grew up. You can just educate, and that is something that is so special about having these. I mean, and you know this, what you're doing is, and good documentarians, they're giving people information that you can then share for the next 100 years.
Exactly.
And so if someone says, I want to know what happened with XYZ, you go, okay, well, here's something, look at this, and then you can see both sides and you can come to understand why. It's not like it's your fault you grew up in this way, but it is important that you understand what's right and what's wrong and what is correct and incorrect. And our favorite Harlan Ellison said something we love: you are entitled to your informed opinion.
Exactly.
Everyone is entitled to an opinion. Everyone's entitled to their informed opinion.
But exactly. You know, just like what Leonard's saying, you know, I grew up in the 50s. Yeah. I thought the FBI was fantastic.
Yeah. Well, he's a boomer. He's born in 1950. You know,
me too.
Yeah. So
I had the same mindset until I started to get educated beyond what I saw and read, you know. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, but again, that fascinates me. Say, Teaneck was one of the first areas that had busing.
Oh no, we were the first town in America to do voluntary busing.
Wow.
To integrate the school. We had eight elementary schools.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the redlining, they were not integrated.
Right.
Though we're all living in the same town. which were about 45,000 population people, at the time.
Right.
And it was a bit jarring to not be assigned to your neighborhood school anymore, necessarily.
Oh, I know.
Getting on a bus and going, you know, all of five to 10 minutes to another school in your hometown.
And your teacher, was it kindergarten and first grade?
No, my kindergarten teacher was Black.
Was Black. It's, again, completely different experiences, right? Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Now, just before we turned on our microphones, I was telling you how I had not yet seen your documentary on the great jazz drummer Max Roach. Mm-hmm. He told me he's going to come up on PBS.
October 6th.
October 6th.
American Masters, October 6th.
Mm-hmm. Have you always been a jazz nut? My dad is a jazz nut, and he made me a jazz nut. Have you always?
I became a jazz nut at the age of 16.
Mm-hmm.
A buddy of mine was a jazz drummer, and I would go over to his house, and he would play a jazz album like Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. And for about 3 months, I didn't understand any of it. I would say, why do you keep playing that? I don't get it. And then like one day I was in the house and he played a Horace Silver tune called Quicksilver, Clifford Brown, Lou Donaldson, Art Blakey, and Curly Russell and Horace Silver. And my brain said, oh, I get it. And then I was into the music. Then I started to study Dexter Gordon and Monk and John Coltrane and, you know, Max Roach, Clifford Brown. And then, you know, I just started listening to everything. And then I picked up an instrument. I learned to play the saxophone. You know, I really got into the music, I mean, I still love it more than any kind of music. I love it.
Well, also
I was going to ask tenor or alto.
Yeah.
Tenor.
That's the big guy.
Because of Dexter Gordon, Sonny Rollins, Jimmy Heath, Charlie Rouse were my favorite tenor players back then. Mm-hmm.
You guys are also so lucky, though, because growing up in New York, you could see the most amazing people.
Oh, I used to go down to the Village Vanguard all the time. Yeah, I used to go to Village Vanguard to see Dexter or Mingus or Max. I love the music.
Isn't it incredible, though, that you've got to see them? That's the thing I will never not be jealous of.
And one of the things I was saying to somebody a few weeks ago, before I ever heard of Spike Lee, I saw his dad with a group called the New York Bass Violin Choir in Brooklyn.
My.
You know, Bill Lee. Yeah, you know. So it was like, I never even heard of Spike Lee before at that point.
Yeah.
You know?
I didn't know of that group.
Oh, yeah. It was a bunch of great bass players, New York bass players that he put together, and they performed. And I went to see him in Brooklyn once in the early 80s or late 70s.
What was your key or your hook or inspiration for your approach to the Max Roach film?
You know, I had been working on a documentary about Langston Hughes, and the director St. Clair had done a sequence where he had Max play a solo to one of Langston Hughes's poems. And I cut that sequence together and I turned to St. one day and I said, somebody should make a documentary on Max Roach. And he said, you should make it. And he introduced me to Max, and I met with Max, and I talked about basically following him for like a year, spending time with him and with his percussion ensemble, and boom, he was also going to San Diego to do a score for a contemporary version of Midsummer Night's Dream. He was going to go to Milan to play with a woodwind and string ensemble. Mm. So I was able to raise money to go with him to all these places and shoot. And the initial idea was to just make a film with just Max being the only voice. Hmm. And I put the cut together and I hated it. I really hated it. And I put it on the shelf for like 5 years. And then I pulled it down. Someone saw this, said, why don't you pull it down? I pulled it down. I made some adjustments, made some changes. I still hated it. I put it on the shelf for another 5-7 years.
Huh.
Then time went by, and around 2015, a colleague of mine who was a cinematographer, who's also a jazz drummer, he asked me that he wanted to see some of my 16 millimeter footage. I showed him some of the footage and he said, man, you got to finish this film. So I said, well, you want to be my co-director? He said, yes. We raised some more money. Then we decided let's interview people who played with Max or knew Max. So we interviewed Jimmy Heath, Sonny Rollins, Abdullah Ibrahim, Dede Bridgewater, Tootie Heath, Warren Smith, everybody who had performed with Max. And we restructured the whole film, you know, and we knew that we had to make it about not only Max as a drummer, but Max as a civil rights activist.
Right.
You know, so that was the hook, to bring in his sort of politics and his musical acumen at the same time. So I think it's turned out to be a pretty decent film.
I want to ask about Sammy Davis Jr. because sure. I love him. And he was, again, you got to see him perform live,
yes,
which is
I did.
Unfair. Did you get to see him on stage?
Never saw him perform live.
Did you get to meet him?
Never met him. But, you know, at 16, I read this book, Yes, I Can.
Yeah.
And I was completely mesmerized by all the challenges he faced and how he overcame them.
Yeah.
So when I was approached about directing this film, you know, I was so familiar with Sammy Davis Jr. from him performing all the time, being a member of the Rat Pack, you know, his relationship with Mike Britt. You know, I just felt like I know Sammy Davis Jr. I know what he struggled with as a Black man in America. So to me, it was like such a honor and pleasure to work this film. And initially, you know, we wanted to deal with the controversy with Nixon, hugging Nixon.
Right.
As
sure.
a way to get you into that film, you know, and the challenges he faced with the Black community.
Sure.
You know, so.
Well, such a fantastic performer.
But
such
complicated.
A complicated life.
Yeah.
Such a complicated life in so many ways, in ways that you expect. And then learning about even the car accident and, you know, all these, what's the joke about the nose? What is the?
Oh yeah. He had plastic surgery after that terrible car crash. And they said, we restored your nose just the way it was. He said, really?
Why?
But you know what I learned from making that film? Because the myth was that Frank Sinatra spent a lot of time at the hospital after he had the accident. But when we interviewed Jerry Lewis, we learned that Jerry Lewis was the one who really spent a lot of time with Sammy at the hospital.
Yeah. They were close. They were both showbiz babies.
Yeah.
That's exactly
I think,
right.
I think they had a connection in part because of that.
They started so
they both literally grew up in show business.
And it was interesting to me about Jerry Lewis. It's one of the few times Jerry Lewis didn't talk about Jerry Lewis so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not easy.
That I know.
Is not easy to do.
I know.
It's amazing when you get someone, if you find the thing that someone loves enough, they can step away from themselves, even their persona, because
that's
they want so much to share.
Yeah. That's right.
You know?
Are you aware, this may be very old news to you, are you aware that when Count Basie and Oscar Peterson made their first album as just the two of them, just dual pianos, they named it Satch and Josh?
No, I never even knew they did a dual album together.
Oh yeah, they did several. For Norman
Count
Grant.
Basie and Oscar Peterson, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You got to hear them.
Okay.
They're great, but they named him Satch and Josh.
Wow. Okay.
Because that's who they were in their field.
Mm.
Wow. Yeah, they were the great Count Basie and the great
Giants.
Oscar Peterson.
Giants.
Yeah. I said that we do also say that people like rappers, terrible nicknames. They ignored. Where do these come from? You have such incredible, ridiculous nicknames from before, and they really knew what they were doing with. I just don't know. I don't get it. How do you come up with like French Montana? That's no good. That's no good. You need something that has a rhythm to it.
Anyway, we've jumped all over the place chronologically, but the chronological truth is that the next film you're going to be able to see by Sam Pollard is called The League, and it is a terrific movie.
It's fantastic.
You don't have to be a baseball nut or a baseball lover to find this interesting. It is an incredible part of the 20th century experience for everyone, Black and white. And I can't recommend it highly enough. It'll be in some theaters on July 11th and then on video on demand on July 14th, a week later. Don't miss it. And Sam, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And thank you for your work.
Thank you very much for talking. Great.
Great
enjoy
to
the
talk
rest
to
of your day. Bye.
Bye-bye. What a pleasure.
What a pleasure.
What a pleasure, that man. My God. Say, so talented, so many great films. You can look up any of his movies and you will learn and you will be impressed. Just incredibly, incredibly talented man.
I'm so glad we got to talk to him. And I really mean what I said about The League.
Yeah.
I was not sucking up.
No, it's a really good film. It's incredible. It's incredible.
About a great subject. And until next time, you can find us.
I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Instagram and Twitter. You're also on Facebook. We have a YouTube channel, Malton on Movies. We do live streams on Sundays. You can always go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff. And we have the Maltreon Patreon.
The Patreon. If you want to help support what we do and let us keep doing it, you can go to patreon.com/maltononmovies. patreon.com/maltononmovies. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. See you next time.